Did you know there's a super useful bot? Yeah, a bot, like a chat bot, a robot you can talk to for NBA fans on Facebook Messenger. The NBA built a bot for Messenger, and it's awesome. You can just message it to watch highlights about your favorite teams and players and videos. Lots and lots of videos. Try it out now by either searching NBA in Messenger or visiting nbabot.net. Again, that's nbabot.net. Game 7, the two sweetest words in the English language, other than default, of course. Danny, you were there. Was it as bad of a massacre in person as it appeared to be on TV?
Yes, it was, Nate. Yes, it was. LeBron, I think, is where we have to start. I was going to say Cleveland played well, but LeBron was absolutely sublime in this game. A different kind of great than he was in Game 5, but he was spectacular.
Why would you say it's different than Game 5?
Well, in Game 5, he was making a lot of shots, and he was a little bit more impactful. And something I think we saw is that the Warriors just kind of stayed away a little bit more. And that is a different kind of an impact. We talked about it, not only calculus's rim protection tries to measure this, is that one of the best things you can do as a defense is try to deter some of the best shots. And I think LeBron did a little bit of that.
Yeah, he did. And when guys did try to go up around him, Steph Curry, Draymond Green, they just got it thrown back in their face, too. He had 3 block shots and 4 steals in this one. The Warriors were held to 11 out of 22 shooting right at the rim. Again, much like in the Oklahoma City series, way below their season average. A further 3 of 11 in the paint outside of the restricted area. So that was pretty awful. When it's really now for their offense, they got to go crazy on threes because they just have not been able to be effective from two-point range. So, and we mentioned this in a couple of episodes previously, that it really has devolved for them now into being what it is that everyone always said that they were, but they weren't. They have not been able to stop the Cavaliers in these last two games. And a lot of the credit for that obviously goes to them, but also just the decline in their defense has been pretty ridiculous in all but Game 4. And then they also just have not been able to get to the free throw line, which they never do, but they have been able to score from two-point range or at the rim, and even 22 shots at the rim is not that many, and then you're shooting a bad percentage on those as well. And the Cavaliers, Thompson, James, even Richard Jefferson getting in on the act, protecting the rim, those guys have played great defense.
And some of the foul shots that they got in this game were by virtue of accumulation, and some of those calls, you know, were of a different variety. You know, it was like silly mistakes and things like that. And along the line of silly mistake fouls, something that I have made you could call it a cottage industry of criticizing Klay Thompson for is committing too many fouls because he doesn't acknowledge or whatever his importance to the offense is, the idea of that, like, he doesn't need to be committing fouls. He's been largely okay on that in this series, and it has transferred to Stephen Curry, who in this game, as much as the Warriors and Kerr, who will probably get fined for his comments, criticized the refereeing in the second half, I thought Curry earned all 3 of his first half fouls.
Yeah, and the thing that's disappointing is 5 of his 6 fouls were not on fouls where someone was actually shooting. You know, you're just committing a dumb foul away from the play, and it's not like he even is getting some huge number of steals either. And now part of that, I think, is just due to his competitiveness now. He's getting put in pick and rolls a lot, especially in the first half. The Cavs have really been able to take advantage of him much better than they were earlier in the series, or certainly last year. And so he's trying hard, but he's committing fouls because they're able to go at him. And this has been the worst his defense has looked in a long time. People saying that he's owed a defensive liability all the time. That's not true. He's been fine in most games this year, but the Cavs have really gone at him. And so part of the fact is just that he's had difficult matchups, and that's part of why he's fouling. And the other part is just that he's making some, you know, dumb plays on loose balls, going for steals when, you know, there's not really much of a point to it. But yeah, that, even the Steph foul trouble, that's not why they lost the game. I mean, they lost by 20. You know, it's hard to say that it would have been much of a difference. And during the competitive portion of the game, they really lost by 13 before he fouled out. So I don't know. I think just the Cavaliers are playing extremely well, and Golden State is just going to have to play better, as Steve Kerr said, because just their offense and defense have not been good enough at all.
Two more kind of big picture things that I want to bring up. And the first, I'll go positive first, is Tristan Thompson was great in this game. He was solid defensively, and offensively, they did a much better job of basically when LeBron necessitated help. He's the best passer. I would say he's the best passer in the league, regardless of qualifiers you want to put on it. And they were exploiting those when they came, and so Tristan was efficient offensively. Then on the other end, basically outside of the Warriors' best players, I don't think anybody, maybe Barbosa, had a particularly good game. And with Bogut out, somebody needs to step up.
Yeah, Tristan Thompson, 6 out of 6 from the field, played 43 minutes and would have probably played 45 or 46 if the game had remained competitive, but still managed to outwork the Warriors. He had 3 assists, which were big assists because the Warriors started trapping on the pick and roll. He was able to make some pretty good decisions at times out of that, which I don't think they believed he was capable of. And then beating guys down the floor, you know, he beat Azili down for a couple of alley-oops. I mean, I think every one of his field goals, I want to say, was a dunk.
I think so.
And an assisted dunk. So there was, too was indicative of the Warrior defense not being at the level that it has been at times. And of course, a big part of that is the fact that Andre Iguodala was injured.
Yeah, and you probably know more about the nature of it than I do, because when you're in the arena, you don't really get many updates on that. And of course, the coaches are always nebulous after the game. What do you know?
Just that it was a back tightness. I mean, you could see him getting worked on by Chelsea Lane, the assistant trainer. And, you know, he had to go back to the locker room a couple of times to have it worked on. But it really was very obvious that he couldn't move at all, that he was not willing to shoot the ball. He got fouled once, but, you know, that was going up very gingerly, and it definitely caused him some pain after that. I mean, it reminded me, I said on Twitter, of Scottie Pippen trying to gut it out with a similar back injury in Game 6 of the 98 Finals, where he kind of tweaked it on the first play of the game on a dunk and then was just gritting his teeth through the rest of the game and actually scored a couple of buckets and like took a charge and stuff, but wasn't himself, which is what made that Jordan performance so good in that game. But you know, you knew the result really wasn't going to be the same. And that the fact that he, you know, it's not only that he's not as good in isolation situations, which he wasn't, but then also just the lack of mobility to get under the screen as well. Tristan Thompson was setting some great screens, but Iguodala just, you know, when you kind of have a back injury, you can't just like tighten up your core, move quickly, change course to avoid guys. If someone makes contact with you, just getting off of them is difficult. And the Cavs really took advantage of that with some borderline illegal screens, which, you know, you always deserve credit for that. If they don't call a foul, it's a good screen. And so Andre would try to go under the screen. Thompson would kind of move with him, prevent him from going under. And then, especially if it was one of the Golden State centers, they just weren't able to do a good enough job on Kyrie or LeBron. And LeBron would get right to the rim, and there'd be no help there, really, from anyone else.
Yeah, and ideally, you want to be able to get some help from somebody other than the person who will get a wide-open dunk if LeBron can make the pass, and LeBron can always make that pass. So it is a challenge in that way as well, just with the reverberations of their offensive success. But one of my favorite phrases was very important in the first quarter of this game, which I think is a little bit lost in the shuffle just because of what followed and the drama and everything. But the concept of feedback loops, I've talked about it a lot with the Warriors, and so the idea basically that success on one end begat success on the other. Cleveland in that first quarter was one of the clearest examples of it, because when they got a stop, they were just annihilating in transition, partially because the Warriors weren't getting back, and partially because they're a really good transition team, especially when they're all hustling. And that is, to me, what created the margin. And some of the Warriors' misses were open shots that didn't go in, you know, and that does happen, of course. But Cleveland did an excellent job of maximizing every opportunity that was created, regardless of how it was created.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, in that first quarter, it really, you know, when it was 6-0, the Warrior defense actually started off pretty good. They're forcing a lot of ISOs from Cleveland, and they were missing wide open threes, Barnes in particular, at the beginning. And then it just kind of steamrolled from there and ended up getting up to a 20-point lead when Steph went out. I thought that Kerr, once it got over 10, should have just brought him back. And while Steph did foul out of the game, in some respects, to me, that almost validates why you should have brought him back in. Because even with him fouling out, the game wasn't close at the end. You know, the closest it ever got was 7 points. And so having him in at the end when it's not even within 10 points, that doesn't do you any good. So you might as well, I mean, especially if you're at home, I get it. But if you're on the road where you've had some horrible starts to halves in that building, when you're struggling to score and to make open shots, I think he needed to put him back in at least, you know, 4 minutes left in the first quarter, 3 minutes left. And just, you know, if he gets another foul, he gets another foul. But I thought Jeff Van Gundy put it great on the broadcast when Kerr decided to leave him in with the fourth foul in the third quarter. Isn't taking him out of the game a bigger risk than leaving him in when you are already down? I mean, if you're up, I get it. But if you're already down and it's getting worse, it's a huge risk to not put him back in because the game could be over in the first quarter. And, well, we watched three more quarters of basketball. It basically was over after the first quarter. They're down 20 and they never really got close again.
Yeah, and something that was concerning in this, and this again ties back to what I usually criticize Clay for, is even when he got that fourth foul and Kerr left him in, Curry was getting really close to fouls and completely on unnecessary things. There was one I think the TV broadcast missed that I saw because I had the right angle on it. Kyrie got past Curry and he just did a completely useless reach. He basically missed on it, so it wasn't a foul because not by intent, but by lack of contact. And you can't do that sort of thing when you're that close on the margins, especially when it's not helping anything. And I think those are the fouls that are the hardest to take because they're not yielding the benefit. I mean, fouls for your best players have to be saved for their maximum utility because otherwise you're going to lose something from it. And I think the Warriors did. As much as, you know, Curry missing the time in the first quarter didn't cost them the game, it sure as hell didn't help.
So we need to get to more on LeBron James. Yes. We already gave him credit for the defense. I want to go through and talk about really all of his assists, all of his buckets, and kind of show what some of the themes running through that were. But before we do that, let us give you a message from our inaugural sponsor, SeatGeek. We're coming up actually on a year now of them sponsoring the podcast, and SeatGeek continues to grow. They sponsor more podcasts, including this one. And the reason they continue to grow is because they offer a great service. They save you a ton of time. They bring together all the ticket buying options, so you don't have to worry that, oh, I went to 8 sites. What if I go to the 9th one? There might be a cheaper ticket. Now it's just all at your fingertips. It's an app, so if you have to go in and do CAPTCHA on a normal site, you don't have to do that on the app on your phone. And of course, my listeners, if you enter the promo code CAPSPACE, which you should do both because of the discount and also to let them know that you came from us, SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. That's the CAPSPACE code. Other reasons to use SeatGeek: every ticket on SeatGeek is ranked based on value, so you can immediately find anything that's underpriced. And you can use SeatGeek's maps to see the view from your seat. And you may have noticed on some other sites, like, say, StubHub, that you select your tickets, you get ready to check out, you're all excited, you're done. Oh, wait a minute, there's some huge fees on the checkout page. SeatGeek tells you what the price is going to be up front to begin with. And if you want to sell your tickets, SeatGeek's also great for that too, especially because they've got that value ranking, so you can kind of just price your tickets fairly and not have to worry that you're doing them way too expensive and no one will buy them, or way too cheap and you're not getting a good price. So remember again, promo code CAPSPACE after you download the free SeatGeek app. You go into the settings tab, click add a promo code, enter that CAPSPACE code, which we talk about all the time on the program, and SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. Download the app, enter promo code CAPSPACE today. So LeBron, we talked about his defense. Here was his line on the game. At one point, he had 18 straight points at the end of the third and beginning of the fourth, really this time when the game was most in danger. He was making his jumper, and overall, he had 41 points on 31 shooting possessions, 11 assists, 8 rebounds, 4 steals, 3 blocks, and was a plus 27, 15 out of 26 from the field. He shot 2 of 5 on threes, 1 of 4 on long twos, but then hit some difficult shots in the lane and was 10 of 13 right at the rim. Very few of those were contested, but part of that was because he was making his jump shot, and then he was able to blow by guys.
Yeah, and there are a lot of different things to unpack in terms of his dominant performance. But for me, what was amazing was the quality of a lot of his assists. It was funny to me that the easiest assists, a lot of them, were to him. Like, granted, the J.R. Smith one was pretty beautiful, but it was, you know, it was a pretty straightforward pass. There was no one in the way. But LeBron just, you like to use the word dimed up, but he dimed up some guys, especially in the first quarter.
Yeah, in the first quarter, Thompson then at the end as well, J.R. Smith, I think he was responsible for three of Smith's four threes via assists, and Smith somewhat of a bellwether usually for the Cavs with the exception of Game 5. But really, I thought the biggest issue for the Warriors was transition in terms of guarding him. And of his shots or assists, seven occurred in transition, but of all of his plays in the first half, six of those were in transition. So that's really how he was able to get started and how the Cavaliers were able to get started as well. And their offense wasn't that amazing outside of that first quarter and then obviously total garbage time at the very end. And so seven were in transition. Then a bunch of other ones were on plays that I wouldn't call good defense by Golden State. And, you know, he's a great player. He's going to punish anything that's not great defense. That's why he does this to every other team in the league except for Golden State. But now in three of the last four games, he's found a way to do it to them also and make them their defense look as bad as he makes every other defense look.
Yeah, and some of the plays also what was so impressive is that it was transition, but he created the transition, and that happened particularly early when he poked a ball away from Clay. I think this was the second score of the game, and then he just ended up getting the dunk as well.
Yeah, that one was ridiculous. He had four or five buckets in pick and roll. When he had Azili in pick and roll and Andre, he was able to find Thompson with some great passes. Three of his passes to Smith were ridiculous. One was a possession was going nowhere. They had like five on the shot clock. Jefferson was double teamed on the baseline. He makes a great cut to give him an outlet, but he's still like under the basket and then jumps in the air, contorts his body 180 degrees and rifles a pass to Smith for a wide open three. Another one, Kevin Love got blocked. James races down in transition, grabs a rebound, and then he's on the right block basically, and in one motion throws a pass over to JR for a three. And then towards the end, there Klay Thompson was kind of loading up on his pick and roll a little bit, but you know, maybe 4 or 5 feet off of JR. And James, because of his size, because of his strength, just throws a pass so hard, so on target, that Klay just couldn't close out on JR. It was a good shot, but that's not a pass that basically anyone else in the league makes. And for LeBron, he was able to be effective the way he wants to, with the ball in his hands, pick and roll. They're not moving the ball a lot, but the Warriors' defense was not able to withstand those attacks from him tonight.
They were not. And yeah, it was on. What did you think defensively? Like, I had trouble quantifying it, but it seemed like he was really the straw that was stirring the drink on that end.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, if you just think about, you know, he probably contested like four or five shots. He had the three blocks. It's a totally different game if he doesn't make that play. He's playing power forward most of the time. And of course, that's another thing to talk about too, is that, you know, Love got in foul trouble, and I thought that actually really helped Cleveland because then the Cavs immediately got to their best defensive lineups.
Yeah, the idea that we've talked about a lot in this playoffs, and I think will be a story of this summer and next year, is the idea of no weak links on defense. The Warriors took advantage of Kevin Love when he was out there, and there are players in this league who are good enough offensively to make up for that, but with these kind of stakes, I think Kevin Love shouldn't be out there that much when you have LeBron, who can do so much of the floor, and Tristan was playing so great. And so I think you're right that they got, incidentally, kind of on a phantom call with his third foul, they actually got fouled into the right lineup.
Yeah, that was a terrible call by Ken Maurer. Draymond Green drove, missed what looked like an easy layup, and Maurer may have called it like after the rebound occurred and as the outlet pass was occurring. And they called it on Love. There was very incidental contact. Draymond actually probably missed it because he got shoved in the back by Jefferson, but Maurer was on the baseline, so he couldn't see that. And he just called it on Love, and that sent him to the bench with his third. And then the Cavs looked great. Love, in his 11 minutes, was -6 and did have 7 points and was able to make a little bit of hay in the post against Livingston, and then Iguodala being hobbled. I think he can actually attack Iguodala as well, and he got to the foul line for 6 attempts. He actually, in his 12 minutes, scored pretty well, but still they were that -6.
Quickly going back to Thompson, I was struck by this, and I think it was late in the third quarter, so this ended up basically being true. He at one time was +20 when the game was +9, and so you think, oh wow, you know, they were outscored by 11 when he was out. He was only out for 3 minutes at that point. So to the team, whether it was a lot of other things, whatever, they just fell apart in the minutes that Thompson wasn't on the floor.
Thompson, Barnes, and Sean Livingston were a combined 2-for-20 in the first half. Steph was really the only guy who was able to get much going, except for maybe Barbosa, who somehow had 14 points in this game in that first half. And again, just 11 points in the first half for the Warriors on 24, or in the first quarter for the Warriors on 24 possessions. I think the lowest scoring first quarter in finals history, I want to say.
It was ahead of Fort Wayne, or ahead of, behind Fort Wayne, and there was another one that were both at 13, and they barely got to 11.
Yeah, and Fort Wayne, I think it is known because they're one of the teams involved in the 19-18 game that led to the shot clock being implemented the following year. So, yeah, you don't want to be behind them in rankings for first quarter scoring.
But something I wanted to talk with you about, that's one of the kind of the benefits of having one of us in person and one of us on TV, is that I heard a lot of grousing about the officiating. And while there were some missed calls, certainly, especially with, I mentioned the ones on Curry, the last couple, I don't think that swung this game, especially because I thought the first quarter was reasonably well officiated.
It was uneven, I thought. I mean, Steph's second foul call, again, probably don't need to be trying to take a charge 23 feet from the basket. When you fall down, when someone hits you 23 feet from the basket, you are basically, I don't know whether you feel like you're there or not. By falling down, most of the time the referee is going to make a call. And 50% of the time, that call is going to be on you, even if you feel like you're there. So by deciding to fall down, you are basically, that's resulting in what, a 30% chance that you're going to get called for a foul? And that's probably optimistic for you. It's probably higher than that.
And the other part of that is that the foul would have been on LeBron, who never fouls out of games. So I don't think that's part of the calculus that Curry was thinking about in that moment, but it is something to consider.
Yeah, and Steph also a further 2 out of 7 on two-pointers. Again, you know, he had a good game. He had 30 points on 24 shooting possessions in this one, although he did have 4 turnovers. But again, just not able to do what we expect to see from him from two-point range, and that, as we've talked about, has been the biggest difference since he's been injured. We've been consistent on that since his first game back in Game 4 against Portland, that he has not been quite the same player. And going into Game 7, they are going to need, like, Game 7 against Oklahoma City, Steph Curry, I think, to win this one, because, you know, 88 points against this Cavs team during the competitive portion of the game, I cut it off basically with once Ian Clark subbed in. But I thought the Cavs weren't going to be able to stop the Warriors. And the last two games, they have very well. And they did in Game 3 also. So, and on the flip side, the Warriors haven't been able to stop the Cavs in those three games. So I think that, especially if Andre is going to be limited, which you have to imagine he's not going to be like 100% at the bare minimum, and he's so key to their defense, he and Draymond, I think the Warriors are going to have to outscore the Cavs, and that's going to just take a monster Steph game, probably a monster Klay game, because Draymond being guarded by LeBron has completely taken him out of the offense in this series.
And the other way that they could swing it would be the other guys making their shots, and while that's a whole lot more likely to happen at home than it is on the road, it's never really that affirming when basically every single other guy has a rough night, most notably Harrison Barnes, but really everybody except Barbosa.
Yeah, Livingston was 1 out of 6. Barnes 0-for-8, 0-for-5 on threes. He is now 1-for-11 on threes, all of which were wide open looks basically in the last two games. But, you know, and Kerr went away from him some in the fourth quarter. When it got out of hand, I probably would have gone back to him just to try to get his confidence going. And I think one adjustment they could make, a small one, would be try to get an early switch on the pick and roll, get Kyrie on Barnes, and let Barnes kind of go to work a little bit and get a little bit of confidence getting something at the rim, because he hasn't been able to get anything at the rim either. And, you know, part of that has been good Cavs defense, and LeBron being there has everyone on Golden State terrified when he's down there, and rightfully so, because he keeps stopping.
And a big concern, as crazy as it is when you consider that he didn't have a point in this game, Barnes also turning down the shots that he turned down is a very important thing, because the Warriors' offense, part of it is that it is producing these open threes, and guys just have to take them. Because Barnes, any shot he takes that is created by him, unless he like has a wide open lane, is going to be worse than an open three, especially if it's a corner three. And he just struggled in that, and then there were other plays where he and Klay both have this weird thing. And there are other guys around the league who do, but it's weird on this Warriors team who sometimes you can just tell by their movement that when they take a couple dribbles that they're going to take the shot regardless of the situation, regardless of what is created. And the problem for those two guys is a lot of times those are their worst shots. And Barnes had one of those on Tristan Thompson where he basically was like, screw it, I'm just going to shoot this. And it was just a disaster of a possession.
Yeah, that didn't go too well for him. And I also think if they really do try to go in the posters, they won't too much. But Barnes is kind of an opportunity double for the Cavs. I use that phrase as, yeah, go ahead and throw it to this guy. We would love to double team him because we'll think he's not used to passing out of double teams and he's going to turn it over. What do you think of Kyrie's game tonight?
He was fine. I think I expected that he was going to have to be great for the Cavs to win another, you know, another game or two in this series. And he was good enough, but he wasn't dominant. Like he was incredible in game five.
Yeah, he was obviously awesome and had to do a little bit more ISOing. Started off hot in the first half. He was actually 5 out of 10 on jumpers and hit some threes as well. Again, some really bad defense on some of those threes for the Warriors. But then he cooled off a little bit in the second half, 7 out of 18. He actually spent a fair amount of the fourth quarter on the bench when LeBron was just killing the Warriors. And again, you know, that was the Warriors' defense now is not as good as it was last year or earlier in the series with Andre hobbled, with Barnes not necessarily out there. If you got to go to Barbosa because Barnes can't hit a shot, your defense is really going to take a hit. The Warriors made some really dumb plays too, just dumb gambles by Green or guys just jumping in the air on LeBron shot fakes. I mean, it's amazing. And it's not even like he's hitting his threes. You know, he's 3 out of 6 tonight and he was 4 out of 8 in the last game. But even, you know, just hitting a few mid-rangers just changes everything about the mentality of guarding him and just his weird inability to hit those shots. And now that he's hitting them again, just even at a semi-passable rate, everything is open again for him, even in the half court. And the Warriors just have big-time problems dealing with him. And I don't think necessarily, I mean, he's now made his jump shot 3 out of the last 4 games. You probably got to start guarding him like he's actually going to hit it.
Yeah, and something I've noticed in this game, and it wasn't true in the entire series, is that I would say we could go back and listen to the tape or just knowing our own thoughts, that going into the series, the two backups that we thought for Cleveland would loom large were Iman Shumpert and Matthew Dellavedova. Dellavedova
and Channing Frye.
And Channing Frye.
All those guys have done nothing.
Yeah.
Shumpert played good D in game five. But that was about it. Yeah.
But yeah. How weird is that? You know, that these guys who was like, oh, well, if they're going to do it, obviously Kyrie, LeBron were always going to be the centerpieces. But, you know, you thought, okay, if they can do something, that would really help. And Shump was a big part of their game three success. But he was a negative tonight, and the Cavs still won going away.
Yeah, and Frye didn't play at all. And Dellavedova only played in garbage time. So Smith was able to get 10 three-point attempts. That's way too much if you're Golden State. He hit 4 of them. That's what he's going to do, probably. I mean, he's a 40% three-point shooter, high 30s. So you got to limit. It's more about limiting his attempts than it is. And 10 of his 11 shots were threes also. And then Thompson going 6 out of 6. And he was just very intelligent with his cuts. And LeBron, again, his ability to make the jump shot, to be facing the floor, force help earlier than the Warriors want to give it. That opens up that pass, and so does getting out in transition. A couple of small notes. Mo Williams played again. He was in the rotation. In the rotation for 4 minutes. They played a lot of time without a point guard. Festus Ezeli, looked like he had a brace on his left knee, actually, which either I didn't notice before or wasn't there before. And he looked like he was moving very slowly, just getting beaten down floor in transition. Usually he is one of the first guys down and back in transition. And he played a little bit better in the third quarter. He was terrible in the first quarter. And the Warriors just continue to get nothing from any of their traditional centers.
Yeah. And there was a situation of just kind of you need to sop up some minutes with those guys, and that none of them are worth trusting at this moment. And that is a concern. And Ezeli, I mean, he was bad. Like I'm writing for the player by player for the Athletic by him. It's like you kind of think of him having a backstop, you know, the idea of, well, at least he's going to bring something defensively and he's going to make these offensive mistakes. And that's kind of a part and parcel of his game. But it wasn't there in the first quarter, but it was there a little bit more in the third. And if they could get even 15 minutes from him, that would be huge. But they didn't get that in this game.
Another thing the Cavs have taken the Warriors completely out of is their off-ball cutting and screening yes. game. One of the things that the Warriors are so good at, which they would do probably 5 to 10 times a game, is enter the ball into the post and then run some split cuts off it, try to get some backdoors. And I think they did that once in the whole game, and I think they actually got a Thompson backdoor cut for a layup on that play. But without Bogut out there, then if you're doing it with Green, he's got LeBron on him, and even getting the ball entered into the post when LeBron is really engaged, I think they kind of, you know, again, like guys shrink from LeBron. He's just that much of a physical specimen. And even someone like Green, who, you know, offensively is doesn't really feel comfortable attacking him. So it's, they do need to look for that more though, but if it's not going to be Green, you know, Andre, maybe he can, try to post up and on someone like Kyrie and get those plays, but he's hobbled. I mean, he clearly, anytime he caught the ball, was just looking to pass it immediately. And I think if you're going to try to play Kevin Love now, or Thompson, just trap Curry and make him throw it to Iguodala and say, all right, Andre, you want to shoot a long two, standing in one spot, you know, make him prove that he's healthy. And I think that's, if he's not healthy, this game becomes like a toss up, maybe even Cavs slightly favored, I think.
Yeah, especially if nobody else can do much, because if Barnes is limited and all that kind of stuff, because they don't, you know. I was thinking about this, actually. I guess the best way to put it is, if they needed to put Draymond on LeBron for extended periods, the problem with that, without Bogut there, is that you lose the help defense that Draymond is so good at. You know, what part of...
Yeah, he can't guard LeBron, especially with LeBron hanging his jumper. Like, he's just too jumpy. He can get in foul trouble. They need him at the rim. He's the only guy who can protect the rim now in some of these units, because their centers just aren't intelligent enough to get there and actually bother LeBron. So, Draymond just has to play off the ball.
Yeah, and the Warriors don't have many other guys that can do that. And Andre typically provides a lot of value other places, but if that is eliminated or weakened by his weakened state, then that will be a problem moving forward. So you just kind of talked about the idea of if Iguodala is hurt being a toss-up. I feel like the Warriors are, you know, they're favorites, but I don't feel like they're significant favorites, partially because the pathway for them to winning this game is a lot different than how they won so many games in the regular season in particular.
Yeah, they just aren't getting quite as many open shots, or at least, you know, I mean, I guess if Barnes were hitting his shots, but they still got up 36 three-point attempts, and they shot 33%. That's not, like, horrible. You know, I mean, you could expect them to hit a couple more in the aggregate, but not that many more. I think their two-point shooting hasn't really been good in the last 13 games now, since the beginning of the Oklahoma City series, so I don't know that you can count on that anymore. And can you count on the defense with LeBron playing like this? And then you have the chance that Kyrie can go off. I mean, certainly the Cavs are more than capable, even if Andre were healthy, the Cavs are more than capable of winning that game, because they have those two stars that you just, if they're feeling it, you can't do anything with them. They can certainly defend them better, but there are times when great defense doesn't matter against those players. And I mean, I feel like with the way that Curry is playing, the Cavs might have the two best players in the series right now, even. I think that's probably right.
Yeah, and so one of the things that you have to kind of weigh in this whole thing is, you know, of the games that we've seen so far, like, which ones are the most relevant? Because, like, I referred in my stuff for The Athletic to Game 4 as the equilibrium game, which was the idea that was kind of where I thought the series was at the time. The Warriors are a little bit better, but that game was in Cleveland. I thought the Cavs' defense wasn't going to be as good as it was the rest of the series. And if you were on that line, then the Warriors should be favored. But even though the Bogut part of it isn't as big a deal, though he is a much better player at home than on the road, which is a point that you've made before, which is quite salient now. But that isn't, you know, that game hasn't been representative of what we've seen in the series, you know, let's say the last four games, or even the last five games. So if you start to lean more towards, you know, Kyrie being more reliably successful and LeBron, like, that game was the low watermark for both of them since the series moved to Cleveland the first time. So I think the Warriors are slight favorites, but it's definitely slight.
So we've had 7 NBA Finals Game 7 since the NBA-ABA merger. Seattle and Washington in 1978, which I'm sure we all remember. Boston and the Lakers at Boston Garden in 1984, which the Celtics won. Lakers-Detroit in 1988, where fans ran on and media ran onto the court with 3 seconds left in the game as Detroit was trying to inbound down three. Houston and the Knicks in 94, which Houston won in a slow-paced, grinded-out series by about 6. San Antonio and Detroit, again, I think the score of that one was 81-74. That was in 2005. Boston and the Lakers in 2010. Lakers won, and again, that was a pretty ugly game. I think that is some of the theme of these, is that these teams kind of come out tight, they're exhausted, it's a bloodbath, and then, of course, San Antonio and Miami in 2013, and probably maybe an example of that not being the case. But all these games were competitive. Not many of them were pretty. Do you want to make a prediction for tomorrow?
Well, I think...
Or not tomorrow. Tomorrow we will not record, and I will sit at home and watch game film. That is my prediction for tomorrow.
Yeah. I have the Warriors as slight favorites, but it's gonna be brutal. And we've talked about before that the Warriors aren't the clutch team probably that they were before, if some of these limitations are true. Obviously, they'll have Draymond, so that will be a little bit different. So I'll say the Warriors win by, let's say, 5?
Yeah. I mean, I think I would, if I were an odds maker, I would, especially not knowing Andre's status. I mean, if I knew that Andre, I mean, what do you think the odds are that he can be recovered by then? Like, he looked ugly. Like, to go from where he was to, like, fully healthy in 2 days, I don't know what happened to him, but it seems unlikely that he's going to be 100%.
Can't go to Germany that fast.
So that's extremely worrisome. I mean, I might make the Warriors 2-3 point favorites in this game. Maybe that's underselling them.
I think that's fair.
The way they've played at Oracle, but with how LeBron has been, how their defense has looked 3 out of the last 4 games, and again, that's been without Draymond too. You know, so I do think that at this point, the Cavs are almost the more talented team in the series, just with the Warriors where they're at in terms of health right now, and they're going to have to kind of win it with great 3-point shooting, with guile, with effort, with behind the home crowd. And, you know, they certainly have a lot on the line historically as well.
Yeah, I don't like to focus on legacies because, I don't know, there isn't much that can be, there's nothing that can be proven definitively. But I will say, since this is the last podcast I think we're going to do before Game 7, that this is an unquestionable legacy game for at least the top 2 stars, but probably a lot more than that, whether it's fair or not. It's going to establish one of these people as, you know, like in their place. And in a lot of ways, for me, for LeBron, I think he should be, unless somebody has an incredible Game 7, I think he's the MVP of this series.
Yeah, I can't really, I mean, unless, like, Steph hits, like, the game-winning shot or something and drops 40 in this game, I think it's, and LeBron has a bad game, I think it probably would have to be him. And I've said before, I tweeted out the link to a podcast I did with Kevin Pelton early in the season, in which I explained why I didn't think LeBron should have been the MVP of the finals last year, because the Cavs couldn't score at all, and he shot a really terrible percentage, and I thought Curry should have been the MVP. But this year, I think there is no argument. I think LeBron has played much better than he played in last year's finals. And, you know, there's not really much of an argument with the way he's played the last 2 games.
And no Warrior has been a consistent positive in the way that LeBron has been. And this series is incredibly close. I believe, I think I heard somewhere that the teams are exactly tied in points right now.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, I can't wait for, this will be my second Game 7 ever in person. Game 7 of the finals, we've only had 7 in the last 40 years. 2 great teams, 2 great players, you know, historically great players, and then tons of other great all-stars as well. It's going to be awesome. But we do have a little bit more to get to, and that is scouting report on Jamal Murray out of Kentucky. I'm trying to get to pretty much anyone who at least can be a reasonable candidate for the Celtics at number 3. And so Murray, a combo guard out of Kentucky. He's Canadian, 6'4 with a 6'6 wingspan, 8'1 standing reach. A little bit undersized for a shooting guard, but has excellent point guard. I mean, I wouldn't say excellent point guard skills. He's got a point guard level handle for sure. And but he's just an unbelievable shooter. Shot 41% on threes for Kentucky this year. That is the number one thing about him that is a huge appeal, especially with the way the league is going right now.
Yeah, I was talking, I think it was on Real Jam Radio with Sam Vecenie, I think it was a little while ago, might have been with Derek Bonner, about what I really like about Jamal Murray is something that's a little bit counterintuitive, and it's that some people really had these high hopes of him being a point guard. And like Zach LaVine, another guy who I've said exactly the same thing about, him being an off guard, I think, really amplifies what he does positively on the offensive end, because he'll get a little bit less attention, but he can still create when the opportunity presents itself.
I think he could play point guard fine in the NBA. I may be a little bit more in the minority on that, but I think he's got pretty good vision. He makes hook passes. He's not like a tunnel vision guy the way Zach LaVine is. And he had played point guard for most of his career until this year with Kentucky, when they basically had a really weird team. They had no wings at all who were any good. They started a nominal point guard, Isaiah Briscoe, at the three, but who just couldn't shoot at all. He might be like one of the biggest record scratch guys I've ever seen in my life, although he plays really hard. And I respect his game. Other than that, it's, you know, they would throw him the ball so often, he just refused to ever take threes. Can't do it. And then Tyler Ulis was at the one, and so Ulis was obviously one of their best players. So Murray had to play at the two. And he did not, a lot of what he did was come off screens. He was unbelievable coming off screens. As his Draft Express profile noted, 42 out of 75 coming off screens. And a lot of those are threes, too. So just incredible efficiency. He moves really well with all out the ball. He has had great coaching, is a gym rat, and just has a ton of intelligence in how he plays, moving without the ball. When he comes off those screens, he can catch the ball. Even if his feet aren't facing the basket, he can turn square in the air. It's a good shot for him. College defenses had no idea how to deal with him coming off screens, because you don't have that many guys who can do that at full speed and then stop on a dime, either hop or 1-2 into a three-pointer like that, basically sprinting away from the basket.
He also doesn't have to do it at the college three-point line. He's confident in his range beyond that, which is incredibly important when you're projecting him out to the NBA three.
He's also really young, played most of the season at 18, so one of the younger guys in the draft. That's another thing to consider when you're projecting him. He's been considered not that athletic, and I think that's true in some ways and not as true in other ways. I think his coordination is outstanding. I think that if he gets some space, he can go in off of 1 foot and dunk on people. And he even can catch some alley-oops, like they ran at the first play of the SEC tournament final against Texas A&M. They ran an alley-oop for him, and he was able to get off of 2 feet and dunk that. So I think that from like a finishing standpoint, I don't think of him as like unathletic. You know, he's probably around the median of NBA point guards and certainly a better shooter. He's a little undersized for a shooting guard, and I think where most of his people talk about him not being that athletic is on defense. I think that he probably will have to end up guarding whoever the weaker of the other teams one and two are. But I do think he's intelligent. I think that he competes, that he's good with help defense, made some really nice plays, you know, on like lobs to fronted post players. He's able to come away and knock it away or come off his guy at the right time, competes on switches as well. He's got a pretty decent frame that I'm sure will fill out. I don't think he's going to be like so bad on defense. You know, would he be below average as an NBA point guard, just guarding other point guards in pick and roll? Yeah, probably. But I don't think he's going to like kill your defense.
I don't think he's going to kill it either. I want to go back a little bit to finishing though, because he shot 65% at the rim this year, which I think is solid enough. You know, it's not like a ringing.
No, for a guard, that's actually outstanding. I mean,
oh, you average, think it's that high? Okay.
Yeah, average is 60. So 65% at the rim for a guard is very good at any level.
And defensively, first of all, I need to go back to something that I've talked about numerous times, which is that a guy who can create offense and capitalize offensively, that is a far more rare thing from a guard, and that needs to be treasured more than a guy who's defense. I hear this about the Lillard-McCollum backcourt sometimes, and it drives me insane. You want those guys because there just aren't many teams that have two players that can do what they can do. And if you have to make that sacrifice, you do make that sacrifice. And one of the things that I really like about Murray is that while I don't think he's great at guarding either position, I think he can do well enough that particularly, I'm sure he'll play some with second units, even though I think he'll be a starter, that there are those guys in the league now who are, you know, 6'5"-ish, who probably play mostly off the ball and can just defend more.
Yeah, McCollum is a guy to whom he is often compared. He's more athletic than McCollum. He's bigger than McCollum, both in terms of his frame and his height. More athletic, McCollum is not going to go in and dunk in transition or catch alley-oops the way Murray has on occasion. I think that McCollum is better in the mid-range with kind of the step-back game, but that Murray is better coming off at 2 feet. He can catch the ball and get a quick release, be more explosive. I think also that Murray will probably be a better finisher than CJ. He's got a great left hand. I really like his floater game a lot also, and he also can kind of absorb contact a little bit better. But I think one of the things that I love about him is he's a guy who can shoot off the dribble, not quite as good off the dribble as he is shooting catch and shoot, but that's true for a lot of people. And that ability to force the opponent to commit two players to you at the three-point line because you can shoot off the dribble in a pick and roll is just one of the things that breaks defenses. And I think he has that ability, and he's still young, and he's going to keep working on his game. And just that shooting, and then I think, you know, he also has a nice floater game, nice touch, good craft. I mean, he's not going to blow by you and create separation, but he's got enough with the threat of his shot that he can get into the lane somewhat in the same ilk as Steph Curry, though he doesn't quite have that wiggle. But, you know, I think it's something that even he can improve a little bit more, and I think he's going to be a fabulous offensive player.
And something that I absolutely love about Murray, and I think is something that's truly special, is he can initiate when you need him to, but he can also be an incredibly valuable player if he's not doing that. Like, I love a guy who can do it when you need to, but does not need the ball in his hands to not only to be successful, but to be dangerous for a defense, because he's so good moving. He's so good with everything he can do off the ball because he's great coming off screens and he's just a threat all the time.
Yeah, I think that's right. And if he's at the two and you have a one who's like a pretty decent pick and roll player, you're probably going to have a pretty darn good offense. I mean, I don't know that I see him as like, all right, dead bang, all-star type of player just due to the fact that he's not like that physically forceful. But I think he's someone who can average, you know, 20 points a game efficiently in the league, you know, and that especially in a draft that's considered kind of a down draft. With his shooting, like, it's difficult for me to see how it is that he would fail entirely, especially when you consider how young he is and he can shoot it this well already.
If he is a team's second or third best offensive player on the court at any given point, that team is going to get buckets. And offenses, you know, we've talked about this before in terms of, you know, when we're ranking guys for most valuable player and things like that. Offense is more important, especially when you're talking about guards. And so from a team building perspective, you're always going to want a guy who can be your primary ball handler. And I don't think Murray necessarily takes away from that. And if he develops that, then that's an even bigger perk. And he has that potential. I'm not going to say that he's going to get there, but he can. And so you're building at the point guard spot or whatever you want to say. You're building that the same way you always were. And then you have a guy who can be a part of it in the rest of your rotation. So what you're looking for then for the rest of your team from a team building perspective offensively is a whole lot easier to find.
Yeah, I mean, I think you never want to say worst case because there can be injuries. You never know what's going to happen with a guy. But I think unless some disaster happens that we don't anticipate, you know, maybe he turns into like a little bit more efficient, like Jamal Crawford type.
Yeah.
You know, that I think that I could see him being that way. And I think he's a better passer than Crawford is, you know, for sure. Probably doesn't create a 2-point jumper quite as well as Jamal did in his prime, but probably a better pure shooter from three, able to go off screens, which Jamal doesn't really do all that much either. And I think, like, I don't think he's a selfish player. I think that he will move the ball. He'll enter the ball into the post when that's what's called for. I just would love to see him in a system with some more space where he doesn't have two bigs and Isaiah Briscoe around him really like cluttering up the floor. And I think that I would try him at the one and see, try him at the two and see. But I think either way, you can make some use of his ball handling and his shooting, and his passing at the two will probably be an asset, maybe a little bit of a detriment at the one.
Have you caught yourself, since now that you've been watching more film, thinking about something that I've been thinking about for the last few weeks, which is his fit with Marcus Smart, theoretically?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I haven't really thought about like who the Celtics should take and where these guys really... I'm sure I will do a podcast, probably. I'm going to have Mike Schmitz on actually next week, and maybe I will try to reveal my top seven. I still got to watch Chris Dunn as well and do the order of my top seven there. And he and I, I'm sure, will talk plenty about that. And he'll tell us a lot about the guys I didn't have a chance to watch that much of. I'm going to try and catch up on them a little bit more over the weekend. So, you know, I think he would be a good fit with Smart, but, you know, you still have Isaiah Thomas on that team, at least for two more years. Maybe Thomas won't be a part of the team after that. And, you know, you're drafting a guy for 8 years or so if you're the Celtics. And same thing with Bradley. Bradley only has 2 years left on his deal as well.
Yeah, I'm not saying they should draft him. I'm just saying that the possibility of, because Smart's defensive versatility, and I think Smart is a little bit, I think he's better off the ball right now than he is on the ball, just because I don't completely trust him on it. That with the two of them, you just kind of try to get into that dynamic of you go, then I go, and work all that. And if that what you could even run them as a kind of more of as a second unit at first, and if they kick ass, then you move them and you make them your starting backcourt.
What do you think the chances are that Murray could become like a real all-star level player?
I don't think it's that high that he becomes like a real, because he's not going to be a really strong defender. Maybe like 10%.
Well, let me ask you this, because we know that most all-star voters don't really care about defense.
That's true. That's a good point.
Offensively, like why is he not going to be that good? I mean, I think we believe in his shooting. Just having seen him at the Hoop Summit in 2014 and 2015, and in 2015 he was unbelievable at that game. He had like 30 points. I believe in his shooting really more than just as much as about any freshman prospect that I've ever seen. He certainly looks a lot better at this point than like say Devin Booker did last year, though Booker didn't have nearly the freedom that Murray did. So I really believe in his shooting. I think he can be an awesome shooter, and that sort of player gets like a ton of run in today's NBA for sure. So
one thing I'll say though on that is that I think he's going to struggle a little bit just with the collection now of bigger twos that exist in the league. Like there are things that I like about him, and then you think about like imagining Klay Thompson on him, and you're like, oh, that would just be hard for him. He can still create space. He'll still score points, but I don't think he's going to be able to dominate those. However, you can of course make the argument that the Klay Thompson and Jimmy Butler are rarities in this league for a reason, and that there are going to be teams that are playing, you know, substandard defensive twos all the time. Those exist in the league and will always exist in the league.
Yeah. One of the biggest arguments against him is he makes it a lot harder, if you're playing him at the two especially, to have a defense where you can switch. You know, he's probably not a guy, you know, if you switch him on to, like, you know, most threes in the league, he's probably going to be too undersized. It's probably not really going to work out. So if you want to have a switching system, he may not work quite as well for that. And then you're kind of limiting yourself. I mean, that's one of the reasons it would be really nice if he could play point guard. But he probably needs to be next to either a point guard or a two who is a better defender than he is from a team building perspective, if you want to really be really good. And he's going to try. I think he is going to try. I didn't see him loaf at all in the games that I saw. So he'll compete. He'll execute the system. So I don't think he's going to kill you necessarily. But if you had two of him in your backcourt, you're probably going to not have a very good defensive backcourt, to put it that way.
I think that's fair.
We do have a little bit of news to get to as well. First, the news on Andrew Bogut. He's out 6 to 8 weeks. Obviously, he's going to miss the finals. We all know that, with basically bruising around his knee from that hyperextension. Very lucky to escape with just that injury. No surgery will be required. And that's huge, obviously, because if he had had a significant injury where he was going to miss the year or part of the year, it's quite likely they could be trying to trade him this summer. Probably even more likely if they lose on Sunday. So this now doesn't prevent that from happening.
Teams will be a little bit queasy about it, especially because he's already been traded once when he was injured. But it is, I mean, with a 6 to 8 week timeline, he should be back. And depending on what the Warriors' situation is, if they decide that they want to move him, it might not necessarily be super early in the process.
So we've been talking up Nando DeColo, who is a restricted free agent with the Raptors, 28 years old, best player in Europe, talking about how he could have made a ton of money this year. No longer. He signed a 3-year extension with CSKA Moscow, according to David Pick and other reports. Don't know how much he's making, but you have to imagine. I was thinking he could have gotten like $8 million a year for 2 or 3 years to come be somebody's backup point guard, but that is now no longer the case, and a crappy point guard market got even crappier as a result.
And it's disappointing because I would have loved to have seen him get another shot. And of course, this is by choice. This was not the NBA holding him out. This was Nando DeColo deciding he wanted to take his talents elsewhere. But it would have been fun to see him in the NBA again.
Yeah, and obviously when you're that money, I mean, it isn't probably tax-free, but they pay you like it's tax-free. So, you know, you actually, if you're making $3 million, you actually get to take home $3 million. That's how it works for a lot of these teams in Europe. So that's understandable that he'd want to play there. I mean, he was a starter. I think he kind of rode the bench his 2 years in the NBA and, you know, just seems to really be enjoying his life there, and totally understand that. J.R. Smith was scheduled to make a little over $5 million, but only 2.2 of which was guaranteed. He had a date of today to opt in or opt out of his contract, per Chris Haynes, and that is in fact what he did. He opted out, which he should have done. He should get at least $10 million a year.
And he had this weird quirk in his contract where he even if he opted in, he was still going to be only partially guaranteed. That wasn't really going to matter because he was a value at his deal, which is why he opted out. But I found it interesting all the same.
Jordan Adams, one of Danny's favorite player, of course, as a UCLA alum, will undergo cartilage transplant surgery on his right knee today, announced by the Grizzlies. The announcement, a little bit weird. He initially, I think, had meniscus surgery after working out in August. Then, a game that we were at, the first game he tried to come back and play was that 50-point blowout that the Grizzlies had at Oracle in, like, the fourth game of the season. And he wasn't able to complete that. I think he came back too early or played too many minutes during that game, or maybe just it was totally unrelated and tweaked it. The press release said that his second injury was unrelated to the first injury. When it's in the same knee and you injure it in the first game that you come back, I'm always a little skeptical of that. And then he tried to come back, was not able to do so. And now, I mean, cartilage transplant surgery is fairly major. And, you know, you have to imagine really that the Grizzlies will not have him in their plans any longer, and he's probably a good candidate now to get his fourth-year rookie option declined. He, of course, was drafted 22nd, and 23rd was Rodney Hood.
Yeah, I'm really disappointed for him and, of course, for the Grizzlies because I think that he could have been a talented player. He was. You like to talk about professional scorers, and I always liked him in that vein. I will say that I didn't hype him up as much as a lot of other UCLA guys just because I didn't love him as much as some other people did, but I still liked him quite a bit. And Memphis is a team that if they had gotten more from the young guys that they've had, it would have made a difference for them. You know, they would be able to kind of be thriving maybe a little bit through the aging of their former stars of the grit and grind era. And Adams is another example of a missed opportunity.
Yeah, I will say he was a favorite of Statistical Translations in large part due to his great rebound and steal rates, because those have tended to correlate very well with good NBA performance. Had some of the best hands I've ever seen on any prospect, regardless defensively, even though he's kind of like a chubby guy in college. He worked hard on his body and had some encouraging summer league performances in his first 2 years. But, you know, you have to imagine that, you know, his career is going to be in need of some resurrection. And it's really a shame. Last thing we have is coaching news out of Milwaukee.
Yes. Jason Kidd, his extension is done. He will be getting $18 million over 3 years. And one thing that's interesting about that is it is not a, let's call it a renegotiation and extension. It is being added just on the end of his existing contract.
Yeah, and he was scheduled to make $5 million. This, of course, is in concert with Justin Zanuck being brought in from Utah to be GM in waiting as John Hammond is going to start sunsetting over the next couple of years, presumably. Kidd has been rumored to be the one who was fighting for personnel control. It was unclear who exactly the head of personnel control was over these last couple of years while Kidd was there, but Kidd is certainly rumored to have been one of the voices behind the Michael Carter-Williams / Brandon Knight trade. And I guess this would seem to indicate that Kidd will continue to be a coach, but is being mollified for the fact that he's a coach only with $18 million
more. How many more GM's tenures is, or potential GM tenures is Michael Carter-Williams going to affect? It's at two now.
You know what the funny thing is? I bet you, like, if Michael Carter-Williams had never been traded, even though that was an unbelievable trade, like, Sam Hinkie might still have his job.
I agree with you, and it makes me really sad considering that Lakers pick is probably either the best or the second best pick owed in the league right now, and that is also a podcast we should do.
Anything else you wanted to say before we go?
No, can I make a couple plugs?
Of course.
So the Orlando Magic offseason preview came out today for the Sporting News. The Phoenix Suns should be coming out tomorrow. We're working on the timing because I'm traveling tomorrow. And then also, of course, for the Athletic player-by-player and analysis, building partially on what we've talked about tonight, and all of that will be up in the next 24 hours.
All right, thanks so much for listening. Follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. Thanks again to everyone who is helping us out with iTunes reviews or ratings. We're actually in the top 5 of the professional sports category today, because not like I obsessively check those rankings or anything. And and in the top 100 overall for all podcasts on iTunes. So thanks a lot for helping us rig those numbers and let us punch way above our weight on that. And we will be back on Sunday night to talk about whoever the NBA champion is, and probably the off-season preview for whoever the NBA champion isn't as well. So that'll be an awesome show. Can't wait for that Game 7 in Oracle, and we will talk to you all Sunday night. Did you know there's a super useful bot, yeah, a bot, like a chat bot, a robot you can talk to, for NBA fans on Facebook Messenger? The NBA built a bot for Messenger, and it's awesome. You can just message it to watch highlights about your favorite teams and players, and videos, lots and lots of videos. Try it out now by either searching NBA in Messenger or visiting nbabot.net. Again, that's nbabot.net.